Charles, January 1966.
Beginning by
asking questions.
Yes, and using an administrative aspect.
Mm-hmm.
And if I may ask, what made you join the Colonial Service?
Well, my father was a civil servant, but I didn't want to, therefore I had a predilection for the civil service, but I didn't want to commute to London every day. Therefore I preferred a job abroad, which meant either the ICS or the Colonial Service.
Would you have preferred the ICS?
No.
I noticed that at this stage a couple of people would rather not have gone there, even if they had the choice.
I had a choice. I chose Ceylon rather than India, Malaya or Hong Kong, because really by chance, because I didn't know about any of them, but I was introduced by the Colonial Office to two Ceylon people, W. L. Murphy and Dane Langtry, both dead there. And I got such a good account of Ceylon from them, which was entirely justified, that I chose Ceylon and never regretted it.
How did you pick up your job once you went there? For instance, did you find that you were given any inkling of what your job was like once you landed there?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I learned the job. My first post was cadet in the candy country. And I learned the job by doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody from the government agent, who was on Kinder's day, downwards, was very helpful to me. The people who rarely taught me were the clerks.
Mm-hmm.
And people like the Katrin Mundell and the Katrin Mahundra and so on.
Yes, I see.
You picked it up as you went along. It was a very good way of learning, I think.
Mm-hmm. It was very much in the empirical British tradition.
Very much so, yeah. Mm-hmm. Not quite well.
Not quite.
It worked quite well,
quite, I think. Right. Yeah. What about the larger issues? Did you feel that, for instance, the colonial secretary whom you met when you landed could have given you an idea of the larger issues?
Well, I think now that I don't think it would have been suitable for the colonial secretary to do this, but I think now, looking back on my service, that there would have been a great advantage if somebody, perhaps the colonial office, had given us background reading material, so that we knew much more about the history and the economics and the politics of the country than we did in fact know.
Mm-hmm.
I knew nothing about this and picked it up gradually while I was working in Ceylon.
Mm-hmm. What about the more general sort of courses that they had later on in Oxford and Cambridge?
Well, you mean the literature courses?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And of course, Ceylon never did these. As you know, the African territories did a literature course before the people did a literature course before they went out to the territory.
Mm-hmm.
Ceylon never did this. It's true that I suppose Ceylon people went on second literature courses. I never went on one myself. And I think that the literature courses served a useful purpose in this way.
Mm-hmm.
It did give the people some general background knowledge to the territory they were going to, which I lacked.
Mm-hmm. And also, would you have liked a bit more specialized instruction on rather peculiar problems like the China problem and tenurial questions in Ceylon?
Well, I don't think so, no, because when you came to deal with that subject, then you got to know about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we'd had not a formal course, but if we'd been given reading material on the subject I've mentioned, history, economics and mm-hmm. political background, it would have been a tremendous advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd have got a grasp of the general problems of the country much quicker than you did in fact.
Because I am somewhat of an academic bent, and I was wondering whether even in questions like the chair problem or general land questions, apart from something on Ceylon, some knowledge of policies in places like Indonesia and India, which presented alternatives, would have helped you in formulating policy in Ceylon.
Well, I think it I think it would have been excellent. But I dare say the people who were actually dealing with these things, like the Land Commissioner's Department, yes, Land Settlement, Forests, Agriculture, for all I know, they may have studied what was done in other places. Mm-hmm. I certainly think they ought to have done so.
Did this empirical sort of training also mean a certain degree of trial by error?
I don't think so. Because, you see, we were filling a niche in an existing organisation. I mean, when I went and started as a cadet in Canada, there was an organisation which I think was pretty efficient already in being. Mm-hmm. And I gradually grew up doing my little bit. In first this and then some other organisation. And taking it pretty much for granted. I mean, it only gradually began to dawn on me until, I should think, probably by the time I had 10 or 12 years service, that the broader political problems, for example, the fact that really I was superfluous because there were plenty of Sudanese who could do the job better than I could. You see? This didn't occur to me at first. I got to be for granted that this was a system and I was there.
Mm-hmm. When you were a cadet, and even as an OA, did you feel that you could have been given more responsibility than was actually devolved?
No, I didn't. I didn't feel that at all. Excuse me. Thank you very much. I forgot to tell you, thank you. Would you like to come to?
Yes,
well, it so happened that I was in Canada. The office assistant in my time was a man called Sudbury, mm-hmm, who had been injured in the war. And he had long periods off duty. He was ill, his head came in trouble. And so I had to do rather more than perhaps than I might have done otherwise. It was a very good thing for me. It pitched me into it and made me do the job. And then after that, once I ceased to be, then I went into the secretariat, which was very instructive. I was a sort of dog's butt. But one of the things that the office of the cadet had to do was to sign letters for colonial secretary or chief secretary, whatever it was. And I used to read the files and to see what had led up to the letter which had been sent out. Of course, this was really the best way of learning the job. Now, I wouldn't say that. I think I got the degree of responsibility which I was capable of carrying, really.
Is there any truth in some of these anecdotes about chief secretaries and governors where sign the thing without even reading it,
some,
you know, on occasions?
I wouldn't think so. Do you mean, depends what the thing is. I mean, often enough I've said, when I was a chief secretary, because I was chief secretary in Uganda, can I sign this flyer? Well, this would be something which was either a formal document, mm-hmm, or else something which I'd previously approved, and I really wanted to know that it had been correctly copied. No, thanks, I've been correctly copied.
You,
I think. But no, I don't think so. I don't think that's really justified at all.
What did I find during my interviews with the civil servants with regard to the training out in the field was that it varied very much. Some felt that they had a good training, and ultimately a lot seemed to boil down to who the particular GA was.
I think this is absolutely true. Yeah. Absolutely true. Now, old Kindersley, when he was government agent in Canada, took me out a lot, which was useful and instructive to me.
Yes.
On the other hand, when I was in some other places, I didn't get out at all. For example, when I was cadet in the office assistant in New Radar, I did all the office work, and the AGA did all the touring.
Yes,
I'm not going to tell you who the AGA was.
Yes, and Mr. Bond was under Campbell in Puttlemer. He was staying with him, so
yeah,
he had a very good training.
Yes.
But others have complained about having hardly any relations with the GA.
Yes, I couldn't complain of that. For example, when I was in Gaul, Wedderburn was the governor general, and he was first ranked in Israel. I learned a lot from him.
Well, he was a very good provincial officer.
Yes, excellent. Yes.
What about the secretariat? You were there pretty early on.
For a short time, about a year.
Would you agree with the Dalmore Commission's view that it was a bottleneck at this stage?
I think it was a bottleneck, but I also think that it was supremely efficient. I think the technical organisation of the secretariat was magnificent. But it was a small number of people dealing with a huge mess of business.
I don't think
the clerks and the system of filing and the proxy writers were making, I mean, far better than this place. Far better than the Ministry of Embassies Development. Much better.
Who had been responsible for this organization?
I suppose it's been gradually built up over the years. It was a bottleneck in the sense that long logistics of publishing, no doubt, would get stuck at the top because they required a long time to consider.
And also perhaps the very volume of work,
yes. If you think of it, you say, what have you got? You've got the colonial secretary, the treasurer, the controller of revenue. These are really the only people who existed at what you might call minister level. Mm-hmm. Below that, you've got all the departmental level. Whereas nowadays, for corresponding volume of business, you'd have perhaps 10 or a dozen ministers.
I'm rather surprised that earlier on, they hadn't, in effect, created more ministers and enlarged the executive council to cope with this volume of business.
You mean earlier when they actually did do so?
Yes.
Which was Donemore in 1933, was it? 34? 31, was it?
Yes. That was, in effect, done for political reasons. But without having a political paraphernalia,
yes.
Purely for administrative convenience. Secretariat might have devolved
yes.
more work.
Yes. Well, I don't know. I mean, I can't. It's a long time ago. I was operating at a low level in those days. I can't say whether that would have been a good thing or not. I would think it might have been to split up. To elevate the colonial treasurer awards to the level of the minister and perhaps two or three other people, like the land commissioner, the controller of revenue, so.
Did you feel, this was in these early days, pre-Donemore, did you feel that the secretariat was tended to be somewhat unreceptive to new ideas and more for a policy of quieter non-movement? I know you were at a very junior level.
I can't honestly say that, but I just don't know whether that is so or not. It wouldn't surprise me, but, I mean, it's so long ago, and I was, as you say, at such a low level, that I just don't know.
Of course, this was just about the time when the commission was due to come out,
that's
and
right.
There were some changes.
Yeah.
What about the political interference and the personal political attacks in council and in newspaper, which seem to have been rather prevalent at this time?
Well, it didn't affect me at all. I mean, no doubt I just took it for granted. The people who were being attacked in the more senior positions perhaps felt it, but it didn't affect me at all.
I wonder whether you can recall any instances when when some of the senior officers complained about it or you know, swore about this interference.
No, I don't recall that at all. My recollections of I can't remember that at all. My recollection of the salon, of course, are much clearer in the later times that I was there. That's perhaps natural.
That's very natural. Do you know if civil servants resented these sort of attacks?
Oh, I know some did, yes.
I was raising questions on this point because the Dalmore Commission went so far to say that the civil service were demoralized as a result. But I was wondering...
I should have thought that was a great exaggeration.
Yes, I was wondering about that.
I should have thought so, yes. But I thought you've got some fairly tough characters like Woods and Sir Wilfred Jackson and the Attorney General. My recollection is that they were perfectly capable of coping with the situation in the Legislative Council, I think in Executive Council, although I wasn't a member of it, of course. Mm-hmm. So.
Yes, Woods was known as Woods' spokesman, and I think he was in effect the government spokesman.
Well, on all the financial things, mm-hmm. certainly he was. He was a much better speaker than most of the other people were. He was a good speaker. Mm-hmm. Jackson was a very good speaker.
Is this St. John Jackson? Or?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
What sort of man was Woods as
a very able, very hard working.
What about the Dodamore Commission itself? Do you know if it consulted civil servants widely?
Well, my recollection is that it did. It certainly didn't consult me, and I was too humble at that time.
Yeah.
I think it did do so.
The impression seems to be that it was Sir Drummond Shields who was responsible for the more radical aspects.
I think that's probably true. Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't know for certain.
I don't know about it, it's quite right.
Another...
Dr. Drummond Shields.
Oh yes, Dr. another thing that seemed to come up was that they favoured having Tom Reed, is it? As secretary later. As
Tim Reed.
Tim Reed.
That's right.
But I'm surprised that they would have favoured him being the chief secretary under this new constitution, because he was not all that senior, was he, at that stage?
My recollection is that Tim Reed was Labour commissioner. I might be wrong there. But I shouldn't know at all.
Someone mentioned it, but he was not certain, the person who mentioned it. You're not certain whether this was true or not.
I've no idea whether it's, I never heard it suggested that Tim Reed should be chief secretary. I think he retired about this time, didn't he, about the time that Dodamore came in.
Oh, I see.
But was he associated in some way with the preparation of material for Dodamore or something like that sort?
There.
I seem to remember him having a special job about this time.
Oh. Maybe that's what brought him to their attention.
Yes.
But since he was a Labour man, he became a Labour MP afterwards,
that's right,
there seemed quite a possibility that yes. Dr. Drummond Shields yes. would favour him being the chief secretary.
Well, you might think that, but I can't remember that ever such a thing suggestion was ever made. It wouldn't be the business of the Dodamore Commission, of course, to suggest who should be chief secretary. It would be outside their terms of reference.
Mm-hmm. What was your own reaction to the whole constitution?
Dodamore?
Yes.
Well, I'm not so critical of Dodamore as many people were. I think on the whole that it served a lot of useful purposes. Mm-hmm. And after all, it lasted until the end of the war and was made to work in very difficult circumstances during the war. And I think it achieved a lot. It gave the Sudanese politicians the opportunity of taking part in the formulation of policy and the supervision of departments. It gave them some practical experience of government work. It produced some people who became, like Senanaka, who became very successful ministers. It accustomed the public service to working under ministers. And it carried the government on from about 1931 to, I suppose, 1947, 48. I think it's true, people often say that it didn't work as it was meant to work, because powerful ministers like Senanaka brushed aside the executive committee and more or less did what they wanted. But still it did work, and I think probably it achieved more than could have been achieved with the old-fashioned Crown Colony form of government. In fact, it would have been totally impossible to carry on with that work.
It's a very interesting view, sir, Mr. Jones. Of course, I think it's also a mistake to think that constitutions always work the way in which they're intended to work.
Yes. Maybe that my views on this are influenced by the fact that subsequently, elsewhere in Kenya and Uganda, I've worked in ministerial systems, which, although there were no executive committees and the Zokri heads and all, and they've got a sort of broad resemblance to the general system which operated there. I mean, I personally am in favour of associating the people of the country with the government as ministers before, long before, they get to the stage of independence. I think that's the right thing to do.
Why? For the training?
Yes. And moreover, because it's a natural desire of people to take part in the government of their own country, isn't it?
And did you feel, not in Ceylon but elsewhere, that this gave a greater drive and a sense of purpose?
I certainly think there was so in Ceylon. For example, the Cook at Ceylonic Department. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think it was so in Africa too. Yes, that's true. But the essential part about it is that, I mean, we have a democratic system here, it's natural that in these territories the people should want to have a voice to their own government, to their own civil service. This is the way to do it.
It is also very interesting to hear you say that it was generally not in favour. Would you say that most civil servants didn't like the idea?
I don't know about civil servants, but you'll find most people, most writers, and I think most of them, criticise the Donald Moore scheme.
Oh, I see.
But in fact, it operated and enabled us to run the country for a period of, as you said, 15 or 16 years, including the period of the war.
What about the general civil service reaction at that time? I know it was, well, there were varying views, but would you say that the majority thought it rather premature?
Rather?
Premature.
I can't recollect that. I expect there was a lot of bellyaching about it.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, of course, most people settled down quite happily under the ministerial system, and remarkably few people retired, with some small degree of compensation.
What did you think of the terms of retirement that were offered?
Well, they're nothing like as generous as what's offered nowadays, but then the change was nothing like so dramatic. You see, after all, the Secretary of State still retained control of the public service at that time. These compensation schemes, which is a matter of fact one of my responsibilities now, they're introduced in territories where the Secretary of State gives up all control of the public service and the territory becomes independent and totally responsible for its own public service.
Yes, I see.
Quite different. Now, I think, I should think there was quite a lot of criticism by civil servants, mainly according to their temperament. But in fact, it wasn't so bad that many people wanted to get out. And some people, of course, would much rather work under a minister than work under the old system.
Oh, you have heard several civil servants?
Oh, yes, certainly. Yes. Particularly those working in civil service ministries. Because they could get money, people like the irrigation department could get money and do the things they'd always wanted to do.
I thought Cyrenaica didn't hit it off with some of the...
True, he didn't hit it off with everybody. But he hit it off with some. I have great admirer of Cyrenaica.
What do you think were his particular qualities?
I think he had drive and imagination and great devotion. Lots of guts and tenacity.
Wasn't he ruthless at times?
Ruthless?
Yes.
In regard to people?
Yes, perhaps, and in his demands.
Can I think of a case? I can't think of a case where I would... I mean, it may have been so, but I wouldn't have been one of the things I would have said about him, personally.
What about... particular bees in his bonnet, you know, particular schemes which he was enamored of and which he rigidly adhered to, whatever.
Against technical advice?
Yes.
There may have been such, for all I know, but I'm not conscious of them. I think by and large, most of the people in his ministries would have said that because of his interest and his drive and his power, of course, political power,
yes,
they were able to do much more than they would have been able to do under a different system.
No, I also agree with you, but I was just trying to get the other side.
Yeah.
What about the grant of universal franchise? Did you favour it then?
Well, I think... did I favour it then? I can't remember, and I think I was probably different.
you know, I probably thought, well, this isn't a thing for me to decide. If they want to head it, well, let them head it. I will get on and implement the scheme.
What do you think about it now, in retrospect?
I think it was right. Mm-hmm. I think it was right. I think that, I know that Sir Robert's run into frightful difficulties. I don't think there's a very due to universal franchise. I think they do other things. It was easier for us to avoid the difficulties which they run into, because if you think of it, the British government had at its disposal a decisive degree of physical power which could be used whenever necessary. Now, this was never stated. Nobody ever mentioned it openly. But it was realised. It was the back of everybody's mind.
Mm-hmm.
So that any row between the Sinhalese and the Tamils over the use of the Tamil language, for example, was inconceivable, mm-hmm. because the government wouldn't have let it happen. It was in a position to stop it happening. So it was really very much easier for an alien government with force at its disposal to cope with problems of this sort than it is for a democratic local government. You see what I mean?
Yes. Regarding this communal split, on the other hand, couldn't you say that at the verbal level, the very fact that there was a third power who was supposed to be an umpire meant that there was more squabbling between the two communities? Squabbling for power, more or less.
Between the Sinhalese and Tamils?
Tamils.
You mean the existence of the umpire encouraged them to?
To pitch high demands.
Yes, and that you mean, what you're suggesting is that the only way that they can ever become reconciled is to fight it out between themselves, I don't mean physically, without an umpire, and gradually get used to each other.
Either that, or a pretty firm statement by the umpire very early on what was going to be the end, and a strict adherence to that, you see.
Yeah. I think there may be something in this, but I think that the real fact is that because the conflict between them would never be allowed to become a physical conflict, the whole thing tended to be damped down.
Yes, I see.
Because I can remember that there was some feeling between the communities. There were those riots in 1914, for example.
15.
Against the Muslim community. Well, now this was really because the Sinhalese resented their industry and their ability to make money and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So the place wasn't entirely free from communal struggle.
No, it wasn't, but it was still not like India.
Nothing like India.
What about the executive committee system itself? What do you think now of its working?
Well, I don't think it was a good idea, personally, assuming that you've got a party system.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, in Ceylon at that time, there wasn't a party system, no proper political parties in existence. And therefore, it was quite a good way, I think, of giving all the people in the Legislative Council the opportunity of getting some political experience and taking a part in the work of the government. I was secretary to GCS Courier at one time for
quite a
long and they took quite an interest in the work of the executive committee, some much more than others. He wasn't a minister who dominated the other people in the way that Senator Larkin did. I think it helped to put a party system to develop.
Did you ever have to attend any committee meetings as secretary?
Oh yes, I had to attend all of them.
Were they rather confusing, and was there much squabbling?
It was a good deal of argument, yes, it was.
And I was wondering whether there was so much argument that hardly any decisions.
No, that's not true at all. I mean, it was possible. It was certainly possible to get business done. I mean, the departments, what did we have? We had the Labour Department,
Industry and Commerce.
Commerce and Industry. Can't remember whether anything else or not. Immigration, did we have? No, I don't think so. Anyway, when a decision required to be taken, it was taken. I mean, it wasn't impossible to work it at all.
Mm-hmm. How did you find Korea as a minister?
I liked it very much.
Regarding this training which this, these committees were supposed to give the politicians, could it be called bad training in the sense that they began to meddle in the wrong things and get a wrong sense of priorities?
Glad to tea. Point out yourself. I don't think so. I wouldn't have said that ever. I wouldn't have said that at all. I mean, I think that one of the handicaps of ministers elsewhere, for example, in Africa, and they don't know what to do. I hate them before you go. One of the handicaps there is that the ministers haven't got any previous experience of government business at all. So I would have said that the advantages would certainly outweigh the disadvantages.
Yes.
It's true that there was a certain amount of intrigue and jockeying, I mean, trying to get jobs for people and trying to get decisions made which would benefit the community or relations or something of this kind. But I think this has been exaggerated a good deal.
Was there a certain amount of love rolling? You support me in this and...
Certainly, yeah, quite a lot.
I suppose that sort of thing is inevitable in committees.
Yeah, I mean it's inevitable in a colonial government executive council. You get ministers doing a deal with each other. Perhaps they don't say so, but it's you know, more or less taken for granted that if the financial secretary gives way to Mr. somebody else, Mr. Abote, over this, then Abote will support him over somebody else. I think this is inevitable. When you've got people who've got to make decisions and are bargaining with each other, I don't think you can avoid it.
Was the whole system cumbersome?
Yes, that's the defect of it. That was the, that's the main criticism, I think, of the executive committee system. It was very cumbersome. See, if you think of the actual physical side of it, I mean, a memorandum's got to be prepared for the executive committee. Each member's got to get a copy of it. I mean, the actual physical side.
Also, did you feel that these ministries tended to work at cross purposes? The different committees and ministers.
Well, I can't remember an instance of it. I mean, there was supposed to be a proper arrangement for coordination between portfolios. For example, the Chief Secretary had the right to attend any executive committee meeting. I remember Tyrrell attending some of ours when he was Chief Secretary.
Well, was that done often at the outset?
Well, it was certainly done in my executive committee. I remember it on another occasion.
There's always someone, either the Chief Secretary or...
No, not always, by any means. But if there was a thing in which he had an interest, then, moreover, I think that, I mean, after all, the minister isn't a fool. If he can see that some other minister has an interest in the thing that he's dealing with, well, then he, I think he would see that he was consulting. Old words, I should think, would come down very heavily on it. Would have come down very heavily on any minister who failed to consult the Treasury about it.
Yes, there seems to have been a considerable amount of friction at the outset, and no doubt much of this would have been inevitable because it was a
new system.
But I was wondering whether the ministers, for instance, were often very unreasonable in their demands.
I don't think so.
I
mean, I think the ministers got a natural desire to do things in their own portfolio. This always happens. They want spend more money on education or hospitals or what have you. And this must lead to arguments of the Treasury. But you can't say they're wrong to want to do this. It's quite right that they should want to do this.
Also, did you feel that the ministers and the whole State Council considered these three offices of state rather an affront and therefore tended to oppose them?
I don't think tended to oppose them, but I certainly think that latterly, they regarded it as being an anachronism that the three policemen, they used to be called, should be there, and that these ought to be ordinary ministerial posts. And of course, it is true that if you compare it with the situation today, a country with the standards of education and development and sophistication and the rest of the world would certainly have passed through a full ministerial system without any offices of state. I think it would have happened much sooner than so long had it been the war.
Well, you think independence would have come earlier?
Oh, no, it hasn't been the war, yeah.
Sir Ivor Jennings had a similar view.
Did he? I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Of course, Jennings was the advisor to the minister, so I knew Jennings well and so on.
With regard to the friction between the ministers and the officers of state, I was wondering whether the personalities of the three officers of state had anything to do with it.
Let's think. I find this hard to answer. Chief Secretary
was Tyrrell
to begin with.
Bert in it for a while, I think.
But Dillon. Was it Dr. Bedillon?
Yeah, that's right. And then Drayton,
yes. I don't know, actually, I wouldn't have thought any of these people were. Tyrrell was old-fashioned, of course. Tyrrell was old-fashioned, he'd been accustomed to a different system. Max Wedderburn, in my opinion, wasn't really suited for the rough and tumble of politics. He was a good provincial administrator, but he wasn't, I don't think, really suited for Lejker and executive council. He was too, wasn't tough enough for it.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. I was surprised that he was able to become chief secretary in the sense that he had always been in the provinces and people like
that. He was an extremely able man, a very able man. I suppose he was deputy chief secretary, I can't remember. But I don't think he got the qualities of toughness, physical and mental and psychological toughness. Mm-hmm. I mean, the ideal man that way was Woods. There was nothing which was said in legislative council disturbed him in the least. And he could always give us at least as good as he received.
But wasn't Woods a bit of the old guard? A bit of a diehard, perhaps, rather of the old school.
He was, but at the same time he was a very able man. I think he adapted himself very well to the new ministerial system, personally.
The impression I had was that...
I'm thinking in regard to financial policy. Because, in those days, I didn't have any opinions about financial policy. You see, this is one of the... You've got to remember that at that stage of my life, I was just a little cog in the machine. And I was interested in playing tennis and reading novels and going for holidays. And I tried to do my work efficiently, but it was within a very narrow sort of horizon, you see. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like you, because your job requires you to take a wider interest. That wasn't so with us. Provided I was an efficient assistant secretary in charge of something or other, well, that was okay.
Mm-hmm. I see. I was wondering whether Woods was rather difficult to get on with, because I heard something about him and Turner. He seems to be L.J.B. Turner.
He might have been around with Turner. I personally worked for Woods on numbers of occasions, and I found him very exacting, indeed. Mm. Very exacting. For example, I can remember once I was a secretary of the Select Committee, and I thought I'd found something wrong with an interim report which they completed before I took over. Mm. So I sent this up to Woods with a note saying, perhaps I was wrong, but I would like the chance to discuss it with him. And I got a note back saying, by all means, any time after 7 o'clock, any evening will suit me. And this was the way that he worked. So he worked till late at night. But if you got used to this, and knew what sort of person he was admirable to work with.
And I should have thought that in any government, anywhere, the man at the Treasury would inevitably...
Yes. I think you'll find plenty of people to criticise Woods. I mean, I think you'll find that they probably blame him for the fact that there weren't salary revisions when there should have been, or something of that sort. Mm-hmm. But I personally had a very high opinion of him.
What about Tyrrell?
Yes, Tyrrell was old-fashioned, mm-hmm. but he was decisive, mm-hmm. and absolutely honest and completely reliable.
How were the governors themselves? I know Thompson was rather sick, but...
I couldn't really form any opinion of any governor until the time of Caldecott. I was secretary to Paul for some years.
Oh, yes.
But until that time, I didn't have sufficiently close contact with any governor, really, to be able to make any estimate of. See, subsequently, when I've been more senior, I've been in close touch with governors. In those days, I don't think it occurred to many, really, to form an opinion of the governor's abilities. He just was there as sort of a part of nature, as it were. You know?
Now, I was wondering whether either Thompson or particularly Stubbs had the imagination to work under this constitution.
I think Stubbs was a very clever person. Stubbs, I think, was a clever man. He was a bit of a stick in the mud, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he was a clever man.
What did you say about Thompson?
He was to me. He was very yes, very bad. Hugh Clifford is clearer to me than Stubbs.
Oh, yes.
Than Thompson.
Oh.
Because when I was cadet at KMT, Clifford was governor, and I used to meet him there.
Well, what were your impressions of?
Oh, I thought he was terrific. Extremely, very, very high.
Mr. Strong was a very high opinion of him. And it's very interesting, if I may take your mind back to this earlier constitution, which was in the familiar Crown Colony model, but which had an unofficial majority.
Yes.
Clifford called it an unworkable constitution.
Mm.
Would you agree?
Yes, certainly.
Then in effect, you wholly disagree with Stanley's verdict that it was a qualified success.
Well, I didn't know that Stanley had said that. But I would say that it's a ridiculous position to have an unofficial majority. It creates a ridiculous... It means that the governor has got to be using reserve powers all the time.
Mm-hmm. Or not using them, and in fact...
Having things go wrong.
Mm-hmm. What surprised me is that such a constitution ever got through at all, you know, that it was set up.
Yeah, I can't tell you the reasons for that. Those days I didn't take... I think perhaps you don't understand the degree to which a young man being put into an existing organisation tends to take things for granted,
mm-hmm.
almost as though they're part of nature, you
see. No, I quite see that, but I was just voicing that view, because I also interviewed Sir Hilary Blood, and he said that this sort of constitution had been worked in Sierra Leone and Gambia and other places. But then I would have said that conditions there must have been very, very different.
Yes. Oh, this is true. There have been other territories where there was an unofficial majority. That's true. It is so. We had it in Kenya one time.
Mm-hmm. How did it work?
Not well.
Mm-hmm.
We had to do a deal with the members on the other side in order to get things through.
What was that happening in Ceylon too? I mean...
Well, I think it would. I think undoubtedly it would.
If I may say so, I found that Sir Murkiston Fletcher was very unpopular.
Yes, I think he was unpopular. I think he was.
Partly because he was perhaps doing these deals.
I don't know whether that was so. He was an outsider for one thing. I mean, he didn't belong to Ceylon. He wasn't a very attractive personality, in my opinion.
What about Stanley? I suppose you had no impressions on him either.
No, except his splendid handwriting. I can remember that clearly.
Splendid?
Handwriting, yeah, he had magnificent handwriting.
I noticed that you were in Batticlow for a while.
I was, that's right, for about a year. Yeah.
And what were your impressions on the Tamils of Batticlow as compared to Sinhalese?
I got on all right with the Tamils, but I never felt the same liking for the Tamils as I did for the Sinhalese.
Mm-hmm. What about your languages? How?
I was quite good at Sinhalese. I passed my examinations about Sinhalese and Tamils.
Mm-hmm.
But I was lucky in Sinhalese because for a year I was Peace Magistrate Gampala, and I had very little work. It's a light court. And a school next door. A school next door to my, between the court and my house was a school.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to get children up to the bungalow after school in the afternoon and give them biscuits and sweets and things to talk Sinhalese. So I became quite fluent in Sinhalese.
Well, that's very good to hear,
learning. It is, because children speak very clearly, you see. And it's more slowly than adults do.
What about the political interference under the Donovan Commission? And, well, Well, there are many instances when they went over the heads of civil servants or criticized them personally in council.
Well, of course, the members of council were all members of the section committee, so therefore they had a perfectly legitimate interest in what was going on. I think cases of this kind undoubtedly did occur, and that civil servants were criticised, perhaps unfairly, in legislative council by politicians. But this is all part of the job, I think. I can't remember if it was in any outrageous way.
And most civil servants took it in their stride.
Yes, so there again, I think it would depend on the temperament of the individual. And you've got to remember, this is the people who would suffer from this would be the more senior people, of whom I wasn't one. I was too lonely ever to be bothered by.
Did you feel that the state council and the politicians tended to be in